Hi everyone, this is Kevin Anand, Ego Strong Voice. It's Sunday, April 28th, 2024. This is the voice of the Republic and the Resistance. Here we stand, broadcasting for a decade now, and furthering the campaign to not only shut down genocidal institutions of church and state, but reclaim the land for all people. A movement that's spread now all over the world, sparked by our common law court movement, that really brought to light the difference between simple protest and organizing on the ground to create alternatives for people to take back the power. Today on the show, I'm going to have a very important interview about that with my sister, Colia Clark, who is one of the leaders of the grassroots civil rights movement in America. And she makes that point how effective organizing in the community takes years, and it's a matter of empowering people to take back the law and the whole society for themselves, as opposed to temporary mobilizations of protest and that. It's a very interesting and relevant interview, and you'll be hearing that in a few minutes. But prior to that, I wanted to remind folks that if you haven't listened to the show before, go to murderbydecree.com and republicofkanata.org. This is the voice of the Sovereign Republic of Kanata and the resistance movement to the COVID corporate police state that we are dismantling piece by piece on the ground, not only here, but in nine countries where our Republic Alliance movement is based. Before we hear the interview today with Colia, I wanted to give you an update about something that's been going on since the new year across Western Canada. There's been a grassroots grand jury convened to investigate ongoing crimes against humanity, against not only Native people, but people all over the region, spearheaded, of course, by China. And a task force was set up. If you remember, we had a West Coast Common Law Court of Justice that convened last November that found Charles Windsor, so-called King of England, and a whole number of other officials guilty of crimes against humanity, including the ongoing torture, trafficking, and killing of men, women, and children all over Western Canada. This grassroots investigation has documented human trafficking, prostitution, and slave labor going on as we speak in crime clusters all over Western Canada, and especially in areas where these corporations operate. PetroChina, Sinopec, which is China Chemical and Petroleum Corporation, Camco Uranium, Liquid Natural Gas Canada, and Horizon Oil Sands. Now, these companies all operate in northern Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia. These camps are guarded by private security contractors and RCMP officers. And in these areas, women and children are brought in routinely for prostitution and are then killed and disposed with. And the RCMP and the Canadian government has imposed a complete media blackout on this. We also have found that in the Camco uranium operations in Saskatchewan, Native people routinely die of radiation poisoning from the in-situ uranium mining going on there. But of course, the area is shut down completely by both Canadian and Chinese military. According to a Cree female eyewitness who we interviewed, who was imprisoned at the Horizon Oil Mackay River camp north of Fort McMurray, Alberta, quote, "I got delivered to the camp by the Mounties who picked me off the street in Edmonton. They must have been a dozen girls like me locked up in that place. They kept us all drugged out. I can't remember how long I was in there. It could have been weeks or months. Who knows? I got lucky. I got out with a guy who took a liking to me. Otherwise, I'd still be in there or dead." Now, this, like I say, is the ongoing genocide that's happening as I speak. At the camps operated by Sinopec, Chinese oil company, near Fort St. John, B.C., and by PetroChina in Mackay River, Alberta, west of Fort McMurray, Indigenous and Chinese women are imprisoned in improvised brothels, often in unheated cargo containers. The women are sick, underfed, and kept addicted to drugs to ensure their compliance. According to a witness who works in the Mackay River PetroChina camp, these women are not only used as prostitutes, but slave laborers, particularly immigrant women from China and other parts of Asia. This source says, quote, "They work them in the kitchen and hauling stuff. The scuttlebutt is they're often homeless or peasant girls from the rural parts of China. They never complain or nothing. None of them speak any English. They're all in pretty rough shape, and a lot of them don't last very long." Evidence obtained by our task force reveals that these Chinese women are brought illegally into Canada through the port of Prince Rupert, West Coast Indian reservations near Bamfield and Port Renfrew on Vancouver Island, and Ballantyne Pier in the port of the city of Vancouver. They were imported initially in ship containers or within false hulls of merchant vessels. The women are then transported by the RCMP and company contractors to hidden storage facilities, including in the underground tunnel system beneath the waterfront and downtown part of Vancouver. From these facilities, the women are shipped to the northern work camps. In some cases, they're used in sex and drug trafficking in Vancouver by the Chinese crime syndicate Triad and its associates among the Hells Angels and the Vancouver City Police and the RCMP. These trafficking networks are common knowledge among Indigenous people and police officers who were interviewed by our task force. The trafficking is also recognized by the United Nations and Human Rights Watch. In the spring of 1999 and again in February 2013, both agencies named Vancouver as one of the three most notorious cities in the world for human trafficking, quote, where the sexual exploitation of Indigenous women and children operates openly with either the tacit or active collusion of government and police authorities, especially the RCMP. Our task force has already identified 9 prostitution and slave labor operations connected to this trafficking network by the aforenamed corporations in BC, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. These operations constitute crimes against humanity under international law and the laws of Canada. But it doesn't end there because it also involves homicide. The zones around the aforenamed corporate operations are well known as places where Indigenous people routinely disappear or die. But two rural areas were identified by our task force as particular hotspots. In northern BC, along the liquid natural gas operations running through the infamous Highway of Tears, Highway 16, between Prince Rupert and Prince George, and in eastern Saskatchewan from the Manitoba border to Saskatoon and Regina. Already a decades-long killing zone accounting for the death of over 900 Indigenous people, Highway 16 in northern BC is now a front line in an ongoing war of extermination being waged against lingering traditional land-based Native communities. For over 20 years, that war has been led and intensified by Chinese and Canadian liquid natural gas companies hungry for Native resources, and by these companies' local Aboriginal accomplices. Since 2016, puppet Native politicians in BC have signed oil and gas export contracts with China exceeding $8 billion. Aboriginal businessmen are now the owners of the strategic Trans Mountain Pipeline, giving them a monopoly of Canadian oil and gas exports to China. To facilitate these deals, Native politicians routinely expel their own tribal members from their lands and collude in the trafficking of Indigenous women and children. In that profitable role, the official state-funded Native politicians, at the behest and in the pay of resource corporations, are primary actors in the death and disappearance of Indigenous people in the Highway 16 corridor. The primary economic engine driving this present-day extermination is China and its resource companies, aided and abetted by the Canadian government and the RCMP. Since the 1990s, the federal government has enabled and concealed the disappearance of many northern Native peoples, including through controlled in-house inquiries into missing women that never result in any action. Similarly to the farcical Truth and Reconciliation Commission that whitewashed the residential school genocide and its murder of over 60,000 children. These so-called government inquiries have consistently fogged the murder of Native people and allow it to continue. In addition, the Harper and Trudeau governments in Canada have formalized China's power and control and ability to inflict this destruction through bypassing the Foreign Investment Protection Act, which allows China to station its troops on Canadian soil and removes all restriction on Chinese investment in Canada. This self-administered genocide, led in collusion with Native politicians, is equally widespread in central Saskatchewan, which is another hotspot for Indigenous disappearances and deaths. Genocide began early in Saskatchewan, after the military crushing of the Indigenous Métis Rebellion in this region during the 19th century. Eastern Saskatchewan harbored the highest concentration of and longest operating Christian so-called Indian residential schools anywhere in Canada, where the average death rate exceeded 50%. Today, more Native people die at the hands of police in Regina and Saskatoon than in any other Canadian city besides Vancouver. Not coincidentally, and like their BC counterparts, the Saskatchewan puppet Native politicians are among the wealthiest in Canada and the most heavily involved in the corporations that are destroying Indigenous lands and resources, including Cameco Uranium, tied to the Liberal Party of Canada, and the Crown and China-affiliated Rio Tinto Mining. These two companies are in the forefront of today's genocidal crimes against the Cree people of Saskatchewan. Now, in terms of the Rio Tinto case, we've talked on the show before about Charles Mountbatten-Windsor's direct complicity in ordering not only the murder of eyewitness William Coombs, but 10 Cree Indians in Saskatchewan, because one of the tribal elders refused permission to have Rio Tinto chew up the land to mine the diamonds. In a nutshell, 6 of the 10 people murdered in one night by a so-called lone gunman, 6 of those people were the relatives of Chief Wally Burns who opposed the diamond mining. Soon after their murder, in that one night in September 2022, he agreed, and the diamond mining went ahead. The Trudeau government and the Governor General and the Archbishop of Canterbury then arrived to dole out $43 million in bribe and hush money to the band council. And they issued this standard cover-up that concealed the crime. But this is an example of what's carrying on today, right in our midst, the ongoing genocide. Now, in summing up that case in Saskatchewan, here's the facts we've established. The James Smith Cree Reservation, where it occurred, these killings were instigated directly by Crown officials, including the present King Charles. The killings were conducted by a team of contract killers hired by Rio Tinto Diamond Company. They acted in conjunction with RCMP officers who provided security backup. Miles Sanderson, the alleged suspect named by the RCMP as the killer of the 10 people, was then murdered by the RCMP in their prison near Melfort, Saskatchewan, by means of lethal injection. Miles' brother Damien, who was aware of the planned Rio Tinto assassinations, was knifed to death that next day by the aforenamed contract killers. An initial hush money bribe of $43 million was issued to the tribal chiefs, as we mentioned, but it was issued through the Anglican Church and Archbishop Justin Welby, who's already a convicted felon for his covering up of mass murder at Anglican residential schools across Canada. To distance itself from the killings, Rio Tinto has declared that its James Smith mining operations will now be conducted by its affiliate Star Diamond Limited. But in truth, Star Diamond is simply a cover for an even larger expansion of Rio Tinto and its Chinese investors into the region in conjunction with the British Crown. This travesty of justice is yet another example of how normalized and deeply embedded in Canadian society is the genocide of Indigenous people, and how no legal mechanism or political remedy exists within Canada with which to confront these crimes, especially when Canadians as a whole remain so indifferent to and complicit in this enormous crime against humanity in their own backyard. That is why we have established the Sovereign Republic of Canada outside Crown jurisdiction for Canadians to disaffiliate from this criminal body called the Crown of England and Canada and to vote with their feet to prevent these crimes from continuing, disavow all of allegiance to the Crown, seize Crown lands, which we're entitled to do under Magna Carta when crime occurs by the Crown, and occupy the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches as reparations, partial reparations, for their mass murder of 60,000 Indigenous children. This is happening as we speak across Canada. For more information, write to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. Go to republicofcanada.org, murderbydecree.com. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, and here now is our interview with our sister, Kolya Clark.
Kolya is with us. So without further ado, I want to get right to our sister, Kolya. Kolya, can you hear me?
I can hear you very, very clearly, Kev. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you, sister? How's it going?
Oh, man, I tell you, it's been a long day, but it's been a fruitful day, so it's going well.
Well, you know, I've been really plugging you with everyone I know, and today's it's just a delight to be back with you. You know, I know we've done TV interviews on MNN TV in New York City, But folks may not know a lot about you. I wondered if you could just take a little bit of time to say who you are, what your background is, how you got into the struggle.
Well, I come out of the state of Mississippi. Let's start with that. That puts you in the struggle the time you're born, especially now, which I came into the world in the 1940s. So Mississippi is home. I grew up in a state of oppression. It was literally a state of oppression. That people talk about now as if it was 100 years ago, but actually it's not that far back. And as the clock turns these days, we are entering a phase of history that I'm very familiar with, and that is the racist and sexual and ugly violence that marked my early years. I started out in a family, though, that was a resistance-oriented family. So I grew up with a family that talked about never bending to evil. And that's really literally is my beginning. I grew up in a family that was multicultural in the sense that we were primarily Africans who came in during the enslavement era, but we were also married the indigenous populations of the state, and of course there's always the rape that came from the European side. So I grew up in kind of this multicultural environment in a very unique area of Mississippi, actually, because the area that I grew up in was the Europeans and the Germans, and more Germans would come with time and when the wars would come, when the World War II came. But there were the Germans, and there was the British, and there was the Dutch, and there was the Scot. Very few Irish, there were Jews, very few. But there were a lot of Iranians and Arabs and these other groups that were in the area. I'm still not clear why. So that kind of a growing up in that kind of a cultural milieu creates for you a unique way of looking at the world. Yeah. So I got a chance to see the world rather than just the European conceptualization of it for me. I got a chance to see the rest of the world as well.
Right.
I grew up in a large family these days. In my day, 10 children in a household was considered a medium family, an average family. I had an uncle with 21, one with 17, and an aunt with 14, so, you know. We were considered the small family.
Was that
but
a hard
I grew
family
up in a family of men. I had eight brothers and a sister. Of course, like most folk in my time period, it was a male-headed household, as were most families in the areas in which I grew up. In fact, in the nation, probably, they tell a lie about it being different, but it wasn't. So I grew up very healthily in one sense, but I grew up in a poor family. So we were itinerant cotton pickers in the late summer, early fall. We would go to the Mississippi Delta. So I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, which is central Mississippi. But we went to the Delta every fall to pick cotton. We'd be up there. I got a chance to see another world that I had not seen before. And this was intense oppression. I mean, really intense. In fact, the houses that we lived in as cotton picking families were more often than not regular homes for the black residents who was moved out so that we would have a place to stay to pick the planter's cotton. And then we would return back to Jackson, and these poor people who had spent a whole summer and were a part of the summer and all of the fall without access to any real income unless they came to pick cotton. And if they did, it was far less than what we were paid to pick the cotton. But you can see the pitching of two groups against each other, the so-called hill Negroes against the bottom, which is the Delta Negroes.
Yeah.
That was a very clear issue. But I also was the fortune of being able to see the other America that nobody talks about, and that is poor white America. Mm-hmm. Because often they were in the fields with us picking cotton side by side with nothing, and I mean literally nothing. And, you know, it's a time of great poverty. But because my parents organized so well, and because we were always landed from the Africans who came out of slavery, and my father's father was a slave, had been a slave, they bought land immediately after slavery ended at 50 cents, 75 cents, a dollar an acre, and accumulated quite a bit of it, actually. So I grew up in this landed family, but despite that, the coming of mechanization meant that they did not have the equipment to farm the land with. It became very, very expensive. And, of course, the federal government, through the Department of Agriculture, would not provide blacks with loans.
Right.
So we didn't have access to loans. So we left the land and came to Jackson. But that is the way I grew up. That is the world in which I grew up. colored school and all. And if I had to do it all over again, I would take the separation. Because it was a wonderful social and cultural experience growing up in these very huge communities without class. There was no class. Everybody in it, because we were the colored people or the Negro people, everybody in it had the same class status. Even if you had lots of money and you were a millionaire, you had the same status as other Africans living with you in within the community. The sad part about it is that the indigenous populations were totally oppressed. We would see them sometimes that would walk through the streets, and they were separated from those the mixed groups of indigenous. So my family and my mother's people are all the mixed groups, but there's a huge separation between the two.
Who are they calling? Who are the indigenous? What groups?
The indigenous were Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Blackfoot, I think it is, Natchez. Let's see about all these groups. The Natchez, forgetting all my indigenous groups. It's a whole battery of indigenous populations.
Right.
My mother had a piece that she would sing to the Creek Nation. She was singing this piece, you know, Choctaw Nation. Creek Nation's going to shine the night, shine by the light of the moon. Mm-hmm. When the sun goes down and the moon comes up, Creek Nation gonna shine. So the Creek were there. So there's loads of them. And then there were mixtures of Maya and other groups that were coming in from Mexico along with what we call Mexicans today.
Right.
All these populations. East Indians, of course, were a small part of the community.
Tell me, Carly, how did you take the step to be involved in the civil rights movement? How did that happen for you?
I was born in it. My grandfather and father brought my father into the farm labor movement. Even though they did not live in counties that housed farm labor movements, they would go there. But people were so bent on change. And I guess some of the populism from the 1890s, early 1900s, also flowed over into the 20th century. They were hell-bent on going to the next door, to the neighboring counties, to struggle with those folk around the issues of farm labor and organizing farm labor.
Right.
It was a huge movement. And my father was a part of that along with, my mother's father and mother's grandfather. So I grew up with a spirit of knowing that we had to, one, change the popular voting system. So we were told that, you know, you had to grow up, you pay your poll tax, and we were required to pay a poll tax, had to be paid on time, and that that would give you entry into being able to demand the right to vote. So both my mother and father was registered voters. So I was born in this space where I was told that I had to fight. In fact, I was required to fight. My father worked, and my mother actually helped to organize. The community helped to organize us, and it was a demand on us that we be a part of the struggle. So when the civil rights movement of the 60s came, I was already a part of it. I mean, it was nothing new for me. I knew that I had a job to do, so I came in and went to college in 59, the fall of 59, and we formed the first NAACP chapter on campus. That did not come from me, actually. The brothers who were coming home from the Korean War, the older students, were interested in forming this first college chapter for the state of Mississippi. And as we prepared in 59, 60 came real quick, because that was September, and it's February 1 of 60 is when the four young people in North Carolina will take a seat at the lunch counter and change the way in which we looked at the world in the South, because it would be caught up in this massive first sit-in movement. Sit-in movement would be followed by just mass mobilizations of all sorts across the South. And that meant that people were going to sit in at libraries and lunch counters and wade into the waters and everything else. So that is the movement that I entered, but I didn't enter it, other words, new.
No.
It was not new. I became a special assistant to the lead man for NAACP for the state of Mississippi, Medgar Wiley Evers.
Okay. And you knew. You worked with Medgar, did you?
Yeah, I was a special assistant for the state. And a really powerful, brilliant man. And he taught me other, you know, techniques for organizing another way also of looking at the world. I got a chance to look at the world through the emerging nationalist movement, because Medgar really believed in the Kenyan approach from Jomo Kenyatta out of Kenya, that you had to fight for what you got and you had to pay any price to do it.
Now, do you think that's why Medgar was killed?
There's no question in my mind that Medgar Wiley Evers was killed because, unlike all of the other civil rights leaders, Medgar Wiley Evers was, one, committed to a state, and he didn't try to be committed to the whole region. He committed himself to the state of Mississippi. He was committed to organizing from the ground up. Maids and whoever else was around, and lawn workers or whoever. He was committed to organizing from the bottom up, and he did that. But he organized the state, and that state, to this day, has more elected officials than any other state in the South, and yet, not just any other state in the South, any other state in the nation. In fact, Mississippi has more elected officials than all of the states combined. If you combine the elected officials across the U.S., you won't have the elected officials that you get out of the state of Mississippi, black elected officials.
So, Colley, this is really important because, you know, I never knew that about Medgar Evers. And, you know, in other words, he was working for self-government. He wasn't looking to the authorities. He was empowering people on the ground.
Yeah, you got to be empowered on the ground. If not, you don't have a base. You've got to develop a base. And that base cannot be a fly-by-night base. In other words, you cannot mobilize folk for the sake of mobilization. There comes a time when you may need to mobilize. But you mobilize from a well-grounded, well-organized base.
Yep.
Otherwise, you have nothing to come home to. And anything can run in and run out. So if we look at the major movements, the mobilizing movements, we looked at America's Georgia, if you look at Birmingham, Alabama, you begin to look around the nation at these movements, they leave nothing behind.
Right.
People come in, they mobilize for a moment, and then they disappear, and you have nothing.
Well,
you've got
the
to
media
start all
up.
Over again, and that's very difficult to do once the people have come through a mobilizing experience, and it kind of falls flat in your face. It is very difficult then to come back to those same people and say, well, you know, we've got to pick up and organize this.
Well, you know, the official version, you know, how the media would come in and Martin Luther King would show up, and they'd all be focused on him, and then he'd leave. Did you find kind of a conflict there?
Conflict, and that was a conflict with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was very much like Medgar's organizing.
Mm-hmm.
The conflict was that we were committed with SNCC to organizing a base. That meant that you organize a new leadership. Whose leadership? Not our leadership. We were catalysts. You organize the local leadership. So you got the Fannie Lou Hamers, the Victoria Grays, and all of these other wonderful people on the ground, and people who were already there organized, because unions had already come through with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and so many of the people that we worked with were already organized and organized in, because they had been trained by these outsiders with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. That's also true for some of the postal workers, and there are a few places in the state where there was blacks who were connected to postal workers. So Amson Moore out of the Mississippi Delta was already organizing because he had been well-trained. So what we have happening is that you have, as an organizer, you're going to produce the leadership, the natural leadership, the earthbound leadership of a people, and they become the leaders. We will take some of the pain that's required to build that. In other words, some of the beatings and the shootings at and whatever else happens and the going to jail will be by the catalytic agents who were there, and we were the catalytic agents. So you've got to organize from the ground up. You've got to have the people themselves represent the people themselves so that you have a natural base, and therefore you can have a living movement, and it will live on.
Right. Well, you're showing so well how one movement feeds into another. This is like a real organic thing. It wasn't just brought in by people from the outside or by any means. But
by no means. And it wasn't new.
No.
If anybody that takes a close look at what happened, especially in Mississippi, which was the wealthiest, in one sense of the wealthiest, cotton state, and because we had long state for cotton, and so Mississippi got to be very popular in the Natchez region and so forth and so forth. But when this trick called ending slavery came, and it was a trick, because it really was probably the industrial capitalists needing to expand their base. And to expand that base, they had to get rid of the old South. It had to die.
and they just make it legal to be slaves inside American prisons, which is 13th Amendment.
Oh, not just prisons. You'd be really a slave on the land, because remember now, when you are a slave, but I would say this, when you're a slave, they feed you, they house you, they clothe you. It may be inadequate and insufficient, but you don't provide that. Mm-hmm. But if I tell you you're free and you had nothing, I mean, you literally had only what you had on your back. You had no land. You had no access to resources for your children. You had nothing. We came out of slavery with nothing, and nobody tells that story. We had nothing but what was on our backs. Yep. Now what do? To go back to the plantation and beg Mrs. to let you back on.
Yeah.
That is what you do. In the meanwhile, through the Freedmen's Bureau, they're rounding up all these black children in the name of that the kids were left abandoned. They also rounded up tens of thousands of white children in the name of abandonment. What do they do with them? They take them to Mrs. and the plantation, and they tell you the lie that Mrs. is going to educate them. So Mrs. has got what? Free labor.
Right.
Slavery is over.
Yep.
You are now trying to find some way of taking care of yourself, and if you've been able to reassemble a family, or you had a family, you've now got to figure out how you're going to feed and help your family. So it's black males who go out and make contracts. They can't read or write.
Right.
Somebody says you to show up here on XX day, and you better not be late. Let's say it's the 15th of January that you have to show at Mr. Jolie's place to do whatever he wants you to do for that date. But it happens to be a cold spirit, so appearance to hit. You have nothing. You don't have shoes. You got to wrap yourself with whatever you can wrap your feet with. You can't make it there. The water is high because it's flooded and it's cold and it's icy. So you get there 5 days late.
Yeah.
And the sheriff is waiting on you. You're going to jail.
Yeah.
For violation of contract. Now you work for Mr. Jolie for 30 days for free.
Yeah.
I mean, this is literally the way it happened. This is not a lie. This is not a game. This is actually what happens. It's all planned. You have nothing. They can't plan Mother Nature, but they understand it's winter season.
Yeah.
They understand that you don't have anything. So now these black males are pulled into a pyramid system.
Well, that explains why there was this huge earthquake building. And I want to get back to the movement, what you saw on the ground. Tell us some anecdotes. What was it like organizing? Tell us about some of these people like Fannie Lou Hamer and the others.
Well, let's do Fannie Lou, because I think she's one of the most beautiful women that I've ever met. I got a phone call. I was down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where we've been organizing Forest County, and that's Hattiesburg is in Forest County, which is south of Jackson, about 80 miles. And we were down there organizing because for the first time a federal tribunal was meeting in the state of Mississippi for the first time since the end of Reconstruction. And so we were down there organizing against a registrar who had refused to even register blacks with Phi Beta Kappa degrees. And it's always saying they couldn't pass the literacy test. So because this was a unique experience, and the government had looked at it, all these people who were well-educated, PhDs and others, and they couldn't get registered to vote. So we've been down there organizing that county to make sure that there was a presence for this federal tribunal that was meeting in Mississippi for the first time and since Reconstruction. I got a call that it was early September, that we were to come to the Mississippi Delta. And so, this is August, to come to Mississippi Delta. So we head for the Delta for a little town called Ruleville, Mississippi. Well, we had headquarters in Bolivar County, at Cleveland, Mississippi. But we would be next door this time in Indianola, Mississippi. And I don't know whether you've heard of Senator James O. Eastland.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is our James O. Eastland. This is the man who's screaming the yellow plague, but also the man who's helping to organize the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, which was designed to spy on us, keep up with us, and also to spread as much madness as possible through black agents.
He owned a big plantation, too, didn't he, that senator?
Oh, huge plantation. But this is his county is a county that houses parchment. And an argument could be made that Eastland owned parchment. This is the state's biggest state prison for the state of Mississippi.
Right.
Known for its ruthlessness and violence.
So is that where you met? Is that where you met Fannie Lou?
Yeah, I'm going to Fannie Lou now. I got to get you there.
You'll get me there. I'm coming.
So we drive this through Jackson all the way up into the Delta, through this little small town. And we pick up Dory Latin on the way out of Tougaloo College. We were the two female state workers for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So we pick her up on the way, and we ride up in this little small town. And sitting there in a little small church house is about, I'd say, 30 people. But surrounding them, going around and around, a four-block square area of cotton fields, is one, the brother to one of the men that had killed Emmett Till. He's a police officer he's one of the two police officers for the town. The other person is a mayor, who is a mayor and sheriff and everything else for the town. He has his big dog and a shotgun, and they're driving around and around this little church house. And we come into this minister who is trying to be brave. You can see this minister is trying to be brave. But we could hear these people singing, and we get in to see this small group sitting up in front, about, I'd say, 30 people in all, spread out across a small church that might have held 100, 120 people. And our job is to keep them in their seats, because we're going to take these people to Indianola, Mississippi, James O. Eastland's headquarters for this county, to get them registered to vote. And this sister, the three of them are just singing. And so we had to preach them, keep them in the seat. The bus was late, 2 hours late at that, because they had struggled getting it from Bolivar County into Sunflower County and to where we were, which was typical and normal. We always knew that they had roadblocks and everything else to block our movement. But I watched this one woman who just seemed to be a firebrand of her own. And they were singing this song, feel a little light of burning, hear a little wheel of turning, just a little talk with Jesus makes it right. So this just a little talk with Jesus, we get on the bus with them, we get them down to Indianola, and we wait all day, and there's no sign of a registrar. The town is located in a little square. We had this county seat for the county. Located in a little square in Indianola. And Indianola, for those who are listening, who know anything about the blues, this is the home of B.B. King and many of the other great blues musicians
really?
That we have for the state.
Wow.
So we're down here in blues territory.
Yeah.
And a blues musician in sight. There's no black folk in sight. Black folk are making sure they stay out of our way and away from, obviously, what is now very negative white power.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, around 4 o'clock, we noticed that these people all got these newspapers. And they had one little bench and right in front of the little courthouse. So one person is sitting there, one white man, with his little newspaper, and keeps looking at the newspaper and looking up at us. Another one the little courthouse had two stories. And it's the only two-story building, the tallest thing in miles. So on top of there is a man standing up looking down on us. He's got a newspaper. So Dora, who I always said, told Dora, I said, Dora, you ain't so bright. Dora decided to take the man's newspaper that was sitting in front of him. She said, give me this paper. So she takes this newspaper from this gentleman. And he sat there. He was just like we were superstars, right? He sat there. He didn't say a word. And then when we said, well, what is this? He just started trying to explain. But it had front pages that the communists had taken over. And we were all communists. And it had the pictures of Bob Moses and but Ella Baker and Ann and Carl Braden, who had been out of Kentucky, known for their struggles around, they were communists out of Kentucky, but they were known for their struggles around organizing blacks in the South. So these people are all on the front page, along with Diane and Jim Bevel, who we knew quite well, and Jack O'Dell, who I will later marry. They were all on the front page. And they were, just communists taking over the South. So we got to get out of here. We look up. Indianola has three highways that converge, 61, 49, and 51. And as we look up, we can see nothing but men in white. They didn't put the cops in blue. They were in white. Highway patrol. We look to our left, highway patrol. We look to our right, highway patrol. All three highways are loaded with highway patrol. So we have to try to get out, and we did try to get out, and this is when I bring you back to Fannie Lou. We were given the task that Bob Moses always protected his female workers, and we just had two. So he put Dorian out of the car with James Bevel and said, y'all get back to Ruleville and let the people know that we have been surrounded down here. Somehow you got to get the hell out of here. Let the people know we've been surrounded and what's happening, and get them to begin to spread the word throughout the county all that we have been overwhelmed here at the, in the NOLA. So we do. They let us through. But as we got through and began to look back, we saw that they had surrounded the bus that was trying to get out. And Fannie Lou Hamer was on this bus.
Oh.
So Bevel, who was had a lot of illness and near the end of his life, was one of the most powerful organizers I know, James Bevel. Mm-hmm. He said, we're going back. So we went back. And sure enough, they let us pull all the way up on the shoulders of the road, didn't stop us. And Bevel was screaming, you know, why you had the bus? Why you had the bus? And one of the highway patrolmen turned to him and said, well, the bus is under arrest. He said, I'm not asking you about the bus. What happened about the people on the bus? They belong to the bus. So he says, well, why is the bus under arrest? It's the wrong color.
Didn't know you could put a bus under arrest.
The bus and all this property was under arrest. Everybody was frightened. I tell you, it was a frightening moment. But then that same woman who we heard this morning, had heard it early in the morning, lit out with a new song, and she was singing, I'm going through. I'll take the way to freedom, no matter what others do.
Right.
I will pay the price. And it was Fannie Lou Hamer. That evening, later on, they kept the bus and they kept everything on the bus, all the people on the bus.
Yeah.
Dora and I went on back with Bevel, dropped us back in Ruleville, and we, you know, went around knocking on the few little doors there was. It wasn't, it was a very small area, letting the people know that the bus had been captured and that, you know, we needed to get together a mass meeting for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we didn't pull off the mass meeting. The bus was set free. And Fannie Lou shows up in darkness, and then walking with one of the male friends from SNCC, when all of a sudden I heard this woman calling my name, and I knew that whoever was calling didn't know, had been looking at some paper and was trying to do the pronunciation, which was inaccurate. She's calling me, Miss Lytle, Miss Lytle, when I'm Liddell. So
That's
Scottish Liddell and not Lytle.
Scottish, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was Fannie Lou Hamer, and she was crying. You could see in this little light rain, you could see the tears running down, just a tear line around, running from her eyes. And she was worried about her husband. She said they called in the name of the plantation owner. You know, he said, put me off. But Pap, he's still out there. Pap, he's still out there. He won't come. He wouldn't come. But so she then explained to us that, in her words, they wanted her to take her registry back. Remember, she's got the broken English here, so she said, take my register back. And she looked and she said, but I ain't going to take my register back. I ain't taking it back. I waited 42 years for this moment. I ain't turning back now. So that was the beginning for Fannie Lou that very evening. Everybody came in from Bolivar County, from our main office with Bob Moses, and everybody gathered, but Dory and I, we were not allowed in this session. They used to put the Mississippians, we had to stand outside. So these Northerners got Fannie Lou. That same evening, there were shots fired. They thought that Dory and I were these three young girls who were actually in the house that we was destined to have stayed in, but we didn't. So these girls were all shot. They lived, but Dory and I escaped because we had already been on our way back to Jackson. So that is a meeting of the one day with all of this, as quickly as I can give it to you, Fannie Lou Hamer, a dynamic woman. Because this woman will now organize the counties, not just one county, but the surrounding counties. We'd be at Cleveland, Mississippi, which is the county next door, adjacent to Sunflower County, Eastlands County. And she would show up, because this is where the headquarters house was, at Amgen Moe's home. And she would show up at... And oftentimes, the FBI would always come in pretending that they were looking out for us, of course.
Yeah.
And they'd sit around and play chess with Diane, or sit around and talk while they spied us out, as if we'd been stupid enough not to know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But they were sitting there this day, and these papers were coming out every day calling us communists. But they would come out for 2 whole weeks. But this day would be the last day. Fannie Lou Hamer came in a normal, jovial way. Morning, everybody. Y'all, I said, so happy, I'm a communist.
And somebody said, what the fuck, do you know you're not a communist? She said, yeah, but I'm a communist, I'm a communist. And the FBI sitting there, they're the red as a beast.
Right.
The people who are running this newspaper are the Hederman brothers, very close bosom buddies of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that afternoon, there was no more communism. No more newspaper.
Well, it's funny, you know, wasn't Fannie Lou, and I don't know if you were involved in Freedom Democratic Party, but she led that fight at the convention, Democratic Convention in 1964.
Well, there's no question about it, she would lead the fight. I just wanted to get you the touch of her beginning here with us.
Yeah.
She'd already been involved, though, with SCAP years ago, not SCAP, but with the school up in Knoxville. Yeah. Years going back, she'd been doing work. She'd been trying to get herself trained. And so we just kind of, you know, she reemerges with SNCC, with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
The Highland Center. She worked at the
Highland Center.
Folk Center.
There,
Folk Center, yeah.
So she had been connected with that for years, mm-hmm. on and off, doing training and this and that. So this was for her an absolute opportunity to be able to live out that life. She said she waited 42 years for that moment.
Yeah.
She wasn't turning back
now.
She made every word of it, because she would pick up here, begin to organize everything that she could find. Now, I was out of Mississippi as of the fall of 62, but Fannie Lou will continue her work, and Dory really can talk a bit at length about having had a more involved experience with Fannie Lou. But she will not only continue the work, she will get involved with the creation of the Freedom Democratic Party, an idea shot forth by Charlie Copps, who was one of the original 16, because there were 16 of us, two females and 14 males, operating under Bob Moses. David Dennis would come in from New Orleans. We had Bob Moses. Bevel was assigned, he and his wife, because Diane got pregnant, they had to go to Dr. King's group. But we operated under their leadership, and Fannie Lou was the highlight. She became, like, I should say, the
right.
spotlight for the revolutionary struggle. But she wasn't alone. There were Victoria Gray, who will come from southern Mississippi. There will be Annie Devine, who will come from Canton, Mississippi, where Black Power will be born, right outside of Canton, on the road outside of Canton, 4 years later.
Well,
these three women will be the women at the National Democratic Convention in New Jersey at Atlantic City.
I wanted to ask you to explain that to people who don't know the history. I mean, they were trying to desegregate the Democratic delegation, is that right?
Well, they wanted to remove the Democratic. The Freedom Democratic Party was organized to unseat the Mississippi Democrats.
Right.
The argument was, you know, the racism, the refusal to allow blacks to not only the right to vote, but to participate in any way in the voting process. So they came here to ask that they take their seats.
Right.
And Lyndon Johnson tried to block this moment.
Yeah.
And he didn't get to the press fast enough, so Fannie Lou was able to tell the story at Atlantic City, at this Democratic National Convention. And the story got out to all humanity, being told by her how she had suffered, what she went through in Mississippi, the serious beating that she had taken in Mississippi. That got out, and Johnson couldn't block it. He was very upset. So what the Democratic Party did, trying to play games with people, they didn't understand these people as sophisticated as they were. What they decided to do was they would give the Freedom Democratic Party a special set of seats. They'd get two seats, right?
Yeah.
They'll give you two delegates. You can sit over here. Well, the party said, oh, we're not taking that.
No,
no, sir. We want.
And they finally got seated in 68, did they?
Oh, yeah, 68, it worked out. Not as Freedom Democrats, no. In 68, they pushed out the Southern Democrats, called the Dixiecrats. They were pushed out for a moment.
Right.
But by 68, you know, we've got a Voting Rights Act.
Right. You know,
You sell my film. If you see the sell my film, folk, of course, that's a project organized by my first husband and I and some other folk. But that film does not include 1964. It doesn't include this fight at the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
Because it's a whole attempt, a revisionist history piece to not present the history of that of the freedom struggle as it really grows and evolves, and where it took us to.
And, you know, today it has such relevance. You know, Coley, I can see we're going to run out of time today. I want you to come back next week and carry this on.
As much as you need. I want to talk to Canada.
Yeah.
I'm excited. You know I want to hear about Canada. And I know you got Katie there. I know I want to hear about the Algonquin, the Mohawk, and everybody else that's up there fighting against the evils of Canada. I understand that we're twin powers here.
Well, you know, I often say, Coley, Canada is a lot more dangerous because everything's hidden up here, you know. The racism is hidden. It's right beneath the surface, but it's just as vicious. There's many Native people died up here as down south and more.
Wow.
So, you know, and we've talked about that on the air, you know.
We have talked about it, and I do understand from looking at it through the African experience, especially during the enslavement era when Canada got seen as the great state of freedom, when blacks were coming from the south and being able to cross into Canada because it had a little quirk law that said if you entered free, you remain free.
Right.
Which Canada is a slave state.
Canada had slaves, both black slaves and
slave state.
Aboriginal
That's
slaves.
Right. That's correct.
The city of Halifax, Montreal was built off slave labor.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also the use of those Africans who crossed in in the name of freedom, they were also working for little of nothing, along with many, many whites.
Now, I wanted you to touch on briefly, we've got about 10 minutes left, and then we're going to have you back next week to talk about today and the struggles you're involved with today. You've run for the U.S. Senate. You're a dynamic activist on the ground, and I want you to talk about that. But tell us a little bit about how you're seeing things these days with the present climate and the struggles going on in America.
Well, I've told people I would not vote for Hillary Clinton because that would be to vote for people who would cause this criminal injustice system that's in the new slavery, as you're saying, within the prison system where our workers are actually working for private sector industries and companies, everything from women's retail to God knows what else, computers and whatever else, working for free. But as we look at this, the election that has just come up with the return to old South values, really U.S. values, but since the North was north of the South, he could tell it as if the South was different than the North. But, you know, when we came north with the Civil Rights Movement in 64, 65, we found a different place. It was America's one composite state, and it's all the same madness. But now what is happening is that for the first time, we get a chance to take a look at the economics of America. We have the emergence of groups brought up by Donald Trump, our present president of the United States. But the groups that bring him to power are very right-wing. By right-wing, I mean the old Southern racist, the Nazi, and many of the others that have been there in the South for scores of years have now reemerged, but they reemerged at a time when they don't understand that the industrial age is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And what Trump has promised them was a rebuilding of that which is impossible, a rebuilding of the industrial age. He doesn't talk about opening coal mines, but didn't say a word about black lung disease.
No.
So he's talking about reopening that when it is impossible to do.
Mm.
Not only because the businesses have gone to Asia, at least out of this country, many of them to South and Central America under the NAFTA agreement, but also because it's just impossible to do. You can't take a people who have not been educated and never had 12 years of education. They were making fantastic sums of money, but on 12 years of education.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we've entered the age, the cybernetic age is alive and well and growing and grows by leaps and bounds daily, you would have to re-educate an entire population of people.
Yeah.
To be able to deal with the new technology.
Right.
And that is what we are faced with. And so Trump said he was taking them back to yesterday, the good old days. I don't know. I was back there then. I'm with Mom's maybe the comedian. I was there then. I don't remember nothing good about it.
Nothing good about the good old days. Slave labor. Yeah.
That you were working in this fairy tale land.
Yeah.
And it lasted from 45 forward. And now it's over. It's simply over. And either we will talk about America, in Dr. King's word, redefining our values, beginning with the value for work, or we can hang this piece up. because it just will not go forward. You can't go forward with unreality.
Right.
Plus, we are making war with all of our neighbors when we look at America. We're making war with all of our neighbors after having made, through NAFTA, made a friendship with Canada, which is quite unusual, too, by the way. America's relationship to Canada. I've been trying to figure that one out in terms of our economic relationship to Canada.
Well, it's pretty simple. We're the resource base. We ship all the stuff south, including the jobs.
Okay, all right.
All the oil, all the water. Anything's for sale, including our everything, you know.
Oh, my God.
That's our role.
So, yeah, we need to look at that role because as we talk about the new America that's emerging here, we have to see that in light of Central America and Canada at all times.
Yeah.
We can see that the war is on Central America right now. And meanwhile, Central America is having its own complications with the Dominicans killing the Haitians, with Mexico sending anything that it can find black to Haiti, at least trying to push it out of the country. All of these variables have to be taken place because everything is like, I don't know, it's like a whirlwind. It's swirling around and around. But right in the center of that is this big empire.
Coley, you know what you remind me of all the time? You know, if people watch the TV too much, they might think that, well, it's the important people that make history, you know, like the presidents and the prime ministers and the queens and kings. But that's not true. It's people like you who've made history on the ground. And that's why I want to give you a voice to talk about this stuff, because it's how we learn our real history.
Listen, we need to talk about that together along with Katie and others, because we are that people. We are all that. All of us who've been out here organizing a lifetime to try to make the kind of real change that's needed in the world. I was in India, and for the first time I understood really how small the world was.
Yeah.
That I was sitting in Mumbai, India, and I could not figure out much difference between Mumbai and Mississippi.
Yeah.
New York, for that matter.
Yeah.
It's a very small world that we live in, made small by this great imperial powers who have traveled across the world murdering their people for one purpose, and that is the creation of capital and control of land.
Yep.
It's just mind-boggling. But America is changing, and it is going to continue to change because we also see a fight back here, a fierce fight back against the emergence of this old imperialism. Other than old imperialism. We see the reemergence of this when we see a powerful fight back. The fight back is kind of a confused fight back because a lot of folk are just fighting back because they want to put Clinton in power. They did not understand Clinton. They didn't see her as murdering up half of the Arab world there. So they thought they were losing something, when really, in one sense, we might have gained something, because now we have room in which to create clarity now that Trump's in power.
Coley, we've got only about 2 or 3 minutes left, but let me ask you if you have any websites, anything you want to announce, and I want you back next week, because I want to talk to you a lot more about all this stuff.
Yeah, we want to talk about Judicial Violence Symposium. Go to the Judicial Violence Symposium.com. JudicialViolenceSymposium.com.
Yep.
Anybody wants to send us notes, can send it to the JudicialViolenceSymposium@gmail.com.
Got it.
That's a Guadeloupe Haiti tour committee that I work on and will continue to work on in terms of the work in the Caribbean. The Guadeloupe Haiti tour committee. And you can get that by just doing ghaiti@gmail.com. We don't have a website. ghaiti@gmail.com.
All right.
Just want to, you know, be in touch. You can call me at 646-657-7207. Would love to hear from you. Or send it to my email. I got a ton of them, but just send it to coleyclark@gmail.com.
Got it. Sister, I love you. I'm glad you were on. Will you come back next week?
I'm waiting. I can't wait to get back. And I can't wait to see and hear my sister.
Yep.
And Don, thank you for hooking me up.
Yeah, and thank you, sister. We will talk to you next week, same time.
All right, darling. Love you.
All right.
Love you. Love you, Canada.
Love you, too. Talk to you soon. And that was Sister Coley Clark from New York City. And like all of us, makers of history. We'll be back next week to talk to Coley more. Follow us in the meantime at itccs.org. And look at the notices there about our new common law program starting in America and England. The fight has just begun, brothers and sisters. You hang in there, stay strong, and stay clear. We're leaving with another inspirational message from our gospel singers. Thank you.
See you next week. Bye for now.